to address its financing needs due to the conflict. We count on the Council and the European Parliament to adopt this emergency macrofinancial assistance as soon as possible.
Von der Leyen says a further 6 billion euro is in the pipeline for Kiev. This is in addition to the 17 billion euro already sent by the EU to Ukraine since 2014. Critics are incensed because the bloc's own agency, the European Court of Auditors, says Ukraine is extremely corrupt. Negotiations between the West and Russia will continue at various political levels in the coming days. Analysts say the only option is for both sides to give ground, because the alternative is unthinkable. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A moment of celebration for supporters of Julian Assange. Another chance at preventing his extradition to the United States on espionage charges. His partner, with whom he has two young children, shared the good news.
The High Court certified that we had raised point of law of general public importance, and that the Supreme Court has good grounds to hear this appeal. The situation now is that the Supreme Court has to decide whether it will hear the appeal. But make no mistake, we won today in court.
In December last year, judges in this court decided there was no ground to believe Assange was a clear suicide risk, which an earlier ruling had found to be the case. Also last year, U.S. government lawyers gave assurances Assange would not be treated inhumanely if extradited. Assurances Assange's legal team and supporters find hard to believe.
The assurances are really misnamed. They aren't assurances and they aren't guarantees, because contained within the very same document is the provision that the United States can withdraw them at any time.
The U.S. wants Assange to face trial over the release in 2010 of thousands of classified military documents relating to U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. Rights groups have denounced his treatment and described it as a serious threat to press freedom.
It's an extremely worrying case, and it will have huge implications for journalism and press freedom internationally. If the U.S. is successful in extraditing Julian Assange and prosecuting him under the Espionage Act there, he would be the first publisher prosecuted under that law, which lacks a public interest defense. That same precedent could be applied to any publisher, any journalist, any source. So we would see likely a very serious chilling effect, in particular on national security reporting around the world, any type of journalism that deals with leaked information. So this is one reason we highlight this case. Is, of course, Julian Assange's own rights are at stake here, but what this means for journalism around the world is extremely alarming.
Today's decision, a partial victory for the campaign to release Julian Assange. It will now be up to the Supreme Court to decide if it will hear Assange's case. But until that happens, his supporters say the fight to win his freedom is on. Saeed Pourreza, London.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in returned from visits to the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt Saturday. In Dubai, South Korean companies inked the country's largest ever single-arm sale, a reported $3.5 billion missile defense system for the UAE. Some South Korean activists worry about the human cost.
South Korea's decision to export weapons rather than trying to help to peacefully resolve the conflict raises a voice of concern over the export, because it generates further tension, conflict, and division in the region.
South Korea's also increased weapons exports to Saudi Arabia. Chung Wook-shik has tracked South Korea's weapons sales for 20 years.
The U.S. military-industrial complex is always mentioned and criticized, but one can question whether South Korea will also gradually develop a military-industrial complex through continued weapons exports.
South Korea has steadily increased its arms development over the past two decades and now ranks as the world's sixth leading weapons exporter. South Korean companies have also diversified their offerings to include tanks, missiles, and even controversial cluster bombs. Saudi Arabia has deployed South Korea's Raybold anti-tank guided missile to Yemen, where the conflict features more advanced weapons. Riyadh's recent airstrikes generated mass demonstrations there, but little interest in South Korea. Activist Chung worries how arms exports will affect diplomacy.
The government, media, and the South Korean people need to reflect about on how our appeals for support for peace on the Korean Peninsula will be considered when South Korea is increasing weapons exports under the rationale of profit and income.
President Moon Jae-in's trip comes as his single term is set to wrap up in May. However, South Korea's arms industry enjoys broad bipartisan political support. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip came together to highlight the plight of the Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails amid the spread of COVID-19 infection. According to Wa'ad Institute for Palestinian Prisoners Affairs, the virus is significantly on the rise among the inmates, infecting hundreds of Palestinian prisoners who have caught the new coronavirus. The statement indicates that more than 100 of the Palestinians have tested positive. These Palestinians say the spread of the virus among Palestinian inmates is the result of Israel's intentional policy of medical negligence.
Israeli regimes keep adopting inhumane measures against our prisoners, depriving them of their basic rights. There is a clear intentional medical negligence by Israeli regime that is aimed on putting more pressure on our inmates.
The Palestinians called on the international community and the Red Cross to provide the required medical care for Palestinian inmates and stop the spread of the pandemic in Israeli jails. Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip say they hold the Israeli regime fully responsible for the lives of the Palestinian inmates, stressing that the prisoners' issue is a top priority and they won't remain silent over these Israeli violations. According to Palestinian authorities, 5,000 Palestinians, including women and minors, are currently held in Israeli jails, with many of them under the so-called administrative policy, which enables Israel to hold them in jail with no charge. The total number of infections among Palestinian inmates has risen rapidly, according to the Prisoners Club statement. Palestinians are calling on the international community to make an action, adding this intentional medical negligence amounts to complicity in the Israeli crimes practiced against Palestinians inside jails. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Iran and the remaining signatories of the 2015 agreement that promised sanctions relief for certain caps on Iran's nuclear program are intensifying the process of drafting a revived deal. Delegates from Iran, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, and the EU have now adopted a new format for discussions, meeting together in one room to focus on the Iranian demands for verified and effective removal of US sanctions and guarantees Washington will not withdraw from the agreement in future or reimpose sanctions. This while expert-level talks continue in other rooms on Iranian nuclear commitments and the sequencing of steps that need to be taken for Iran and the US to go back to full compliance. European and American officials have been raising concerns about the amount of time left to reach a conclusion, with some diplomats suggesting they only have weeks, and other sources citing early February as an unofficial deadline.
If Western countries give the necessary assurances, the necessary guarantees, and if they remove the sanctions, then that will be enough. But if they want to drag their feet, if they want to be slow about it, then the negotiations will be slow. For Iran, that is the issue. Dates, the length of the negotiations, whether it takes a week or a month or a year, that's irrelevant. Because the Iranians know if they get a bad deal, there's nothing that they're going to be able to do about it. So they have to make sure that the Europeans and the Americans are unable to cheat them at the negotiating table.
Sources close to the talks say the negotiations are progressing at a normal pace. To claim that the talks have stagnated is unfair, they say, because resolving the outstanding issues requires further discussions given the complexities of the problems. Homolezki, Vienna.
Today, on this January day, my whole soul is in this, bringing America together, uniting our people, uniting our nation.
That was how Joe Biden laid out the path for his presidency during his inaugural address on the 6th of January 2021. It came after supporters of his predecessor Donald Trump raided the Capitol Hill in a deadly unrest because the former president refused to accept defeat and claimed an election fraud. Speaking exactly a year after he took office, Biden said he had not overpromised in his inaugural speech on what he could achieve. Yet, a review of the status quo in the United States tells a different story. Back in October, a poll showed that 41% of Biden's supporters and 52% of those who voted for Trump want Republican and Democratic-led states to secede and form two new countries. The divide continues to define the American society and politics to the day. On Thursday, the U.S. Senate blocked Biden's key legislation to protect voting rights for African Americans and other minorities, especially in the Republican-controlled states. Democrats pushed the legislation amid restrictive voting in some Republican-led states, which Democrats see as a slow-motion coup to retake the White House in the next presidential election. Republican-led states also moved to restrict teaching critical race theory in schools. That's teaching students on the history of slavery and racism and how they shaped U.S. institutions and policy to ensure the dominance of white people. One such ban did actually become law in Mississippi on Saturday. The debates hark back to racial tensions triggered by the fatal shootings of African Americans, which have ignited some of the most serious social unrest of the modern times in the U.S. A case in point in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in November. The not guilty verdict in the trial was an affront to those who saw the teenager as a murderer, butting into a protest against racial injustice and killing two demonstrators. The ruling, however, was a gift to those who saw Rittenhouse as a right-wing patriot. Over the past year, the U.S. has also seen huge divisions among Republican and Democratic voters over such issues as the conservative-led push to restrict constitutional abortion rights, obligatory vaccination against the coronavirus, and even Democratic-led attempts to curb access to guns. These have also been key areas of political point scoring among Republicans and Democrats.
One thing I haven't been able to do so far is get my Republican friends to get in the game of making things better in this country. I did not anticipate that there'd be such a stalwart effort to make sure that the most important thing was that President Biden didn't get anything done. Think about this. What are Republicans for? What are they for?
Deep divides have always been there among Democrats and Republicans and their supporters, but the Capitol Hill insurrection seems to have radicalized things. Trump continues to enjoy backing from Republicans after he triggered the insurrection by the claim that Biden won the election by vote rigging. This has polarized American politics more than ever before. The insurrection has also sent reverberations through the American society, dividing people across political and racial lines.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
vacation on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Athlaid. The grim images of bodies lined up one next to each other, the result of a deadly Saudi-led airstrike on a Yemen prison that claimed 91 lives so far, described as nothing short of a carnage. This was a massacre that the Saudi-led coalition said that it had not actually executed. It was not aware of, is what their words were, yet they were undeniably responsible for it. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why Saudi Arabia and the UAE continue this losing war, and whether the recent strikes on the UAE risks putting in danger the wider region due to Saudi and Emirati's reluctance to stop bombing Yemen.
Yemen continues to reel from a Saudi attack on a prison facility in Sa'dah province, with the number of fatalities continuing to rise. The airstrike that took place early on Friday left hundreds of people dead and wounded. Mohammed Al-Khulaidi was one of the victims. He describes how he was injured.
The missile hit ward number 3, and I was in ward number 2. My mates and I were sitting and chatting about our release from prison and how our cases will stand with a judge, and what would happen after we are released. Then the plane struck at around 1:30 or 2 a.m. Suddenly, piles of debris were on top of me.
Yemenis say there was no military target nearby the prison, and the attack was unjustified.
There were only inmates in the facility. There were no forces to be targeted. Even their weapons pick up trucks. Why did they strike? I don't know why they hit us.
Yemeni officials are calling for an international investigation into the latest Saudi bloodshed.
We denounce this act against those prisoners who were killed unjustly by aggressors. Some of the victims are children. The Saudi-led coalition has crossed all red lines. We call on the international community and human rights organizations to stop the Saudi aggression, condemn this attack, and bring its perpetrators to justice.
The air raid drew widespread condemnation, including from the UN, which also called for a transparent probe.
The Secretary General condemns the airstrikes launched by the Saudi-led coalition against a detention center in Sada. Attacks directed against civilians and civilian infrastructures are prohibited by international humanitarian law. The UN calls for prompt, effective, and transparent investigations into the attack.
Iran has also condemned the attack, calling on the UN to hold the perpetrators of the crime to account. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a war on Yemen in March 2015. Since then, hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have lost their lives. Despite relentless Saudi bombardments of the impoverished country, the Yemeni armed forces and allied Ansarullah fighters have gradually grown stronger, leaving Riyadh and its allies, most notably the UAE, bogged down in the country. They have repeatedly conducted retaliatory attacks deep inside Saudi Arabia. A turning point in the conflict came last week when the Yemeni army opened a new retaliatory front, targeting the UAE capital Abu Dhabi and its commercial hub Dubai with drones and ballistic missiles. The army called the attacks a warning to Emiratis to change their stance and keep away from Saudis. Despite the enormous loss of lives and destruction of vital infrastructure in Yemen, the UN has done nothing to stop the mayhem and has only released a few statements once in a while. This as Riyadh continues to receive arms from its Western backers, most notably the United States and Britain. With no end in sight, the situation seems to be bleak for the Yemeni people unless a collective international effort is made to stop the aggression.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have Elijah Magnier joining us. He's a veteran journalist and political analyst with years of experience covering the West Asia and North Africa region. Thanks for joining us, Ben Norton, journalist, writer, filmmaker, and editor of Multipolarista, who joins us from Managua.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both, and I'll start with you, Ben Norton, if I may. We're looking at an airstrike that happened on Yemen in this prison or detention center. We're looking at 91 that were killed, and it warranted for the Yemeni health ministry just days ago, on Friday, I believe, to come out showing what was really a brutal, shocking image of bodies lined up one after the other, where on full display you're having a country saying this is what's happening to us. And, you know, the UN, of course, in some sense coming out condemning this airstrike, but the coverage of this did not amount to what it warranted when you took a look at those scenes and what happened in that one instance. Why do you think that this incident, similar to other incidents that have killed civilians, is not given the media coverage that it should?
Well, unfortunately, the reality is, in at least in Western corporate media outlets, if they can't blame one of the big boogeymen of the United States, such as Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, then they're not really interested. We've seen, for instance, over the past several months, torrents, 24/7 coverage of Ukraine with these outlandish claims without any evidence that Russia is planning to invade Ukraine. Meanwhile, with the support of the United States and Britain, Saudi Arabia has been massacring Yemeni civilians. And I want to recall another very similar incident that happened in 2016, over 5 years ago now. That was when Saudi Arabia bombed a funeral hall in Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, killing over 150 people, injuring over 500. This is not the first massacre of civilians we've seen in Yemen. Unfortunately, there have been a lot of incidents like this. And as in the 2016 massacre at the Sana'a funeral hall, I suspect that this attack was carried out with weapons that were created in the United States and Britain. So that really, I think, answers your question, why there's so little coverage of this in Western corporate media, because this is not just a Saudi war. This is a war that, since it began in March 2015, has been supported by the United States and been supported by Britain. And I want to remind viewers, I'm an American, I'm from the United States, that in the United States, this is very much a bipartisan war. Now, there are a lot of American citizens who are against the war, but when it comes to the U.S. political class, both the Democratic and the Republican parties have supported this war for now 6 years. And it began under Barack Obama, and it was continued under Trump, and now has continued under Joe Biden. This March will be the 7th year anniversary of a war that has gone on, and hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have died. And again, to answer your question, why is this a little coverage? Unfortunately, because Western corporate media outlets continue to carry water for Western governments, and they don't report on things that do that damage the foreign policy interests of Western governments.
Okay, now here's where it gets interesting, unfortunately, Elijah Magnier, which is really depressing in a sense, where you have the Saudi-led coalition that's fighting the Ansar fighters coming out denying that this airstrike was something that they did. I mean, they came out and point-blank said that. Now, as far as I recall, aren't they the only parties that are dropping bombs on Yemen and conducting airstrikes?
Inevitably, Saudi Arabia denies everything, that every war crime that is committing. This is not new. The Saudis have been doing that since the beginning of the war, attacking, as your guest said, rightly, funeral, a wedding, market, hospitals, prisons, everything. They don't distinguish between any target, civilian or non-civilian target. So, yes, the Saudis deny everything, and they are supported by the British and the Americans on the ground. We know that the special forces from different Western countries are present in Yemen, supporting the Saudis and guiding their air missiles against specific target, and most of the time, without their support, just bombing, carpet bombing the city of Sana'a and also all around Marib and other parts of the country. It is normal when the United Nations is afraid of dragging Saudi Arabia to a criminal court and accuse it of committing war crime, because the Saudis have already threatened the United Nations of not doing so and not declaring its responsibility of its war crime in Yemen, because the Saudis are financing the United Nations, as they are indirectly financing many states by buying weapons and by supporting their economy. Okay. So we don't expect less than that.
Well, let's open the UN picture here, Ben Norton. And I'm going to come at you with what the Saudi-led coalition actually said about why they had no idea. They said because it was this site that they hit, which they said they didn't, was not included on what they said was a no-target list that was agreed with UN agencies. Now that in itself kind of gives the impression that the UN says, yeah, give us a list that you shouldn't hit, but you can go and hit the rest, whatever it may be on their list. But they went a step further, this so-called Saudi-led coalition, and they accused the Ansarullah fighters of spreading, and I'm quoting, spreading unspecified misinformation about the attack. What do you think they mean by that?
Well, we've seen the exploitation of this term misinformation and also disinformation used by really every government around the world. Washington spearheaded this propaganda drive. Anytime Russia correctly says something, the U.S. says it's Russian disinformation, and now we see another example of this. But I want to remind viewers that when we're talking about Saudi Arabia, what is the Saudi military? The Saudi military was created first by the British, and then it was recreated by the U.S. The Saudi military is basically a U.S. proxy. It was created by the U.S., and they were the pilots were trained by the United States, and they are flying U.S.-made planes or British-made planes. They are flying, they were dropping missiles that were made in the United States, Britain, or France. I should mention France's role as well. They are doing so with the support of U.S. and British military advisors. We know from reports in the British media that the United States and Britain have had their military advisors physically on the ground in Riyadh in command and control centers. They have also had access to the lists of targets of the airstrikes of Saudi Arabia. And although Saudi Arabia claims it doesn't bomb civilian sites, this is simply false. It is blatantly contradicted by years and years of evidence. Again, we're talking about a war that this seventh year, it's already been
sure
now. And we, because Mundi, who is a leading specialist on Yemen, London School of Economics, she's published that the intentionally bombed sites in Yemen repeatedly. Data that we have available shows that over of the airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and Yemen have hit a mistake. Over one civilians, that's clearly intentional.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm going to jump in, Ben Norton. I think you were actually finished there. We were getting disconnected on and off. But Elijah Magnier, our guest there from Managua, Ben Norton, is zooming in on the U.S., quite rightly so. Let's go with that line. And I'm going to ask you about these, what the UAE calls militias, that they're paying for, in essence, that are fighting the last particular region, which is called the last stronghold in Marib. Now, based on a 2015 report that came out, a lot of these mercenaries actually came from Latin America, leaving the ranks of their national armies to fight in Yemen. And what is very interesting is that these mercenaries from Latin America, and it could be from other countries also, for sure there are being flown into the UAE, and guess who trains them there? You have U.S. military trainers that trains them in the UAE, and then they go into Yemen and they do their fight. So how active is the U.S. when we take a look at this particular aspect of their involvement?
Well, when Joe Biden arrived to power, and even during his campaign, he really condemned the Saudi attack on Yemen and said they should be held accountable. And he said he's going to stop the killing of children. Then we see that he is doubled down on his promises. And not only that, he's supporting the Saudis, as Secretary Blinken said, that we are going to support our partners, particularly after the bombing of the prison that is only happened a few days ago. So the Americans are extremely heavily involved in this war, and the Saudis cannot fight. They went to Syria by paying two mercenaries to fight on their behalf. They went to Yemen doing the same, collecting soldiers from Egypt, from Sudan, from all over the places, trained by the Americans, and the Americans don't care. They've trained Al-Qaeda in Syria, and knowingly they were Al-Qaeda. So the Americans, as long as you pay them, they're happy to support the Saudis, as long as the Saudis are paying the money and buying whatever the Americans want them to buy. We don't have any conscience here that is on the table. We have only a Saudi crime that is committed every single day with the full approval of the international community, not only the US and Britain, but Germany, Canada, France, Italy. Everybody is supporting this Saudi war against Yemen.
Right.
So everybody is also training the Saudi mercenary that are paid by the Saudis and injected in Yemen, because they are afraid of the fall of Marib now. Mm-hmm. And this is why they are bombing Sana'a every single day to stop the advance of Marib.
Well, just briefly, if you can, Ben Norton, expand if you have information or knowledge about the extent of the U.S. training when it comes into the picture. Another fact that's pretty alarming when you take a look at it is since the year between 2000 and 2015, the U.S. spent $7 billion to train, advise, and equip Colombia's security forces. And then you have this, strategy to prepare them for an emerging industry that they call the export of security. Again, just one country that I'm zooming in on, but the U.S. involvement there, of which we now know the UAE had mercenaries come from Colombia at some point. There are other mercenaries also here. The extent of the U.S. involved in this war and entities around it making money off of it, is it pretty wide?
Absolutely. And what we see here is also the influence of neoliberal ideology when it comes to imperial overreach around the world. So we see that the U.S. has this idea of privatization of war, outsourcing war to mercenaries, to private firms, and Colombian mercenaries are one of the favorite choices of the United States. We see that the U.S. and the Colombian military collaborate very closely. U.S. military officials train the heads of the Colombian military, and these Colombian paramilitaries are notorious around the world. In fact, they've been involved in recent cases, including the assassination of the former president of Haiti, Jovenel Moise. They were also involved in attacks in sovereign Venezuelan territory, an operation the United States eventually aborted, but that was planned to assassinate the alleged of Bolivia, Luis Arce, and the Colombian militaries who were fleeing Bolivia for that operation. So we've seen expansion around of these trained Colombian paramilitaries that are secured guns. They go wherever they are service U.S. empire and paid money to carry assassins, their hitmen. In the case of Yemen, it's not that surprising that the Houthis, these, you know, reactionary anti-revolutionary forces that around Asia have been trying to stamp out all revolution anti-imperialist forces existence, it's not surprising to see they have teamed up with some of the most reactionary anti-revolutionary forces in Latin America, which is Colombia. We should see the shared ideological interest in countries like Colombia and Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I want to remind our viewers that the revolutionary former president of Venezuela, Chavez, infamously referred to as the Israel of Latin America. And when Hugo Chavez said that Colombia was the Israel, he meant that it serves the same role that it serves for the as an outpost of Western imperialism to try to dominate the region and press all anti-imperialist, all revolutionary foreign in the region.
Well, Israel, notion of it. Elijah Magnier, let's talk about that a little bit here, the cooperation the UAE has with Israel. We know it's centered on, as it's been reported, in terms of, for example, Socotra Island, how that's being set, that has been set up as a spying center. But since the reaction came when the Yemeni army saw the extent that the UAE was getting involved, especially area of Marib, we had come by the PM, Bennett, we can come to your rescue, we can help you. Is that a signal that the Israel is now going to be proactively involved, or are they in the now, they're slowly leaning on with the Prime Minister Bennett making that kind of statement?
Israel has been involved with Saudi Arabia since more than 20 years, support the Emiratis offering intelligence services. And the support of the Israeli to the Emiratis has gone beyond that in the island of Socotra, not only when the Houthis bombed Dubai and Abu Dhabi, Israelis were extremely worried because it is more or less the same distance between Sana'a and Eilat. And why they're very worried now, because they feel that the Yemenis can hit Israel, because they will discover, and that will be announced very soon about the Israeli movement in Yemen,
sure.
Particularly because of the navigation in the Red Sea and the islet takes to the maritime line of the Israeli.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask the last question from you, Ben Norton. Tap on your journalism feature here, and that is the way that words are played into the news when describing what's happening. The coalition intervened in Yemen, a 25th major news source, nationally recognized government. Well, as far as I know, there was no internationally recognized government when it was a one-man vote. Abd Rabbah Mansour Hadi, backed by Saudi Arabia. Never forget how he went and he voted for himself. So, you know, that tell us your impression of that and this intervention that they call that Saudi Arabia and its coalition did, which is not what is obviously the case.
Yeah, very short history lesson. I mean, it's hilarious to see this propaganda in the media. So when Ali Abdullah Saleh was overthrown, Abd Rabbah Hadi was handpicked by Gulf monarchies to be his replacement. As you said, he won a so-called election, scare quotes, in which he was the only candidate. And then he overstayed his constitutional term in office. He has no constitutional legitimacy whatsoever. So let's remember, where has Abd Rabbah Mansour Hadi been this entire war?
Sure.
He has been living in Riyadh, living in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
Hadi, a Saudi puppet. Everyone in the world knows that. But of course, we see this linguistic game here. His government is referred to the internationally recognized government, even though they have no legitimacy inside the country. They don't actually live in Yemen.
Thank you so much. I'm Scott, which is fresh out. Journalist, writer, and editor of Multipolarista. Thank you so much. Goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We will be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Not a single day passes without a Palestinian tree or an orchard being set ablaze or cut down. Clearing the Palestinian environment is, and has always been, the prerequisite of constructing or expanding Jewish settlements. For these colonies to be built, countless trees have to be removed, along with the Palestinians who have planted them. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ramzi Barud, journalist. This article is titled, How the Israeli Regime Occupation Ravages the Environment in Palestine. Stay tuned for more. Those who are not familiar with how the Zionist regime, particularly the Zionist regime military occupation of Palestine, is actively and irreversibly damaging the environment, might reach the erroneous conclusion that Tel Aviv is at the forefront of the global fight against climate change. The reality is the exact opposite. In his speech at the UN Climate Change Conference, COP26 in Glasgow, the Zionist regime's right-wing Prime Minister Naftali Bennett pushed the Israeli brand of innovation and ingenuity to promote clean energy and reduce greenhouse gases. The Zionist regime uses this particular brand to sell everything, whether to promote itself as the savior of Africa, to help governments intercept fleeing refugees, to push deadly weapons in the global market, or as Bennett has done in Scotland, supposedly save the environment. Just before we hastily dismiss Bennett's rhetoric as empty words, we must remember that some are actually buying into this Israeli regime propaganda, one of whom is the American billionaire Bill Gates. The day following Bennett's speech, Gates met with the Zionist regime prime minister on the sidelines of COP26 to discuss the establishment of a working group to study potential cooperation between the Zionist regime and Gate Foundation in the area of climate change innovation, the Times of Israel newspaper reported recently. According to the newspaper, Gates, who had asserted in his meeting with Bennett that only innovation can solve the problem of climate change, said, "That's really what Israel is known for." Gates' obsession with innovation, however, might have blinded him from addressing other issues that the Zionist regime is also known for, namely, being the world's leading human rights violator, whose horrific track of record of racial apartheid and violence is known to every member of the United Nations. However, there is something else that Gates might also not be aware of. The systematic and purposeful destruction of the Palestinian environment, resulting from the Israeli regime occupation of Palestine and Tel Aviv's insatiable appetite for military superiority, thus constant innovation. Every act that is carried out to entrench the military occupation consolidates the Israeli regime's colonial control, and expanding illegal Jewish settlements directly impacts the Palestinian environment. Not a single day passes without a Palestinian tree or an orchard being set ablaze or cut down. Clearing the Palestinian environment is, and has always been, the prerequisite of constructing or expanding Jewish settlements. For these colonies to be built, countless trees have to be removed, along with the Palestinians who have planted them.
Over the years, millions of Palestinian olive and fruit-bearing trees were uprooted in the Zionist regime's constant hunger for more land. The soil erosion in many parts of occupied Palestine speaks volumes of this horrendous ecocide. But it does not end here, of course. For hundreds of illegal Jewish settlements hosting a population of more than 600,000 settlers to survive, a heavy price is being exacted from the Palestinian environment on a daily basis. According to the thorough research of Ahmad Aboufu, an independent legal researcher with Al-Haq Rights Group, illegal Israeli settlements generate around 145,000 tons of domestic waste daily. Aboufu reported that in 2016 alone, around 83 million cubic meters of wastewater were pumped throughout the West Bank. Moreover, the Zionist regime has near total control of Palestinian water resources. It relies on the occupied West Bank's aquifers to supplant its need for water while denying Palestinians access to their own water. According to Amnesty International, the average Israeli receives 300 liters of water per day, while a Palestinian receives a much smaller share of 73 liters. The problem is accentuated when the water usage of illegal Jewish settlers is taken into account. The average settler consumes as much as 800 liters per day, while entire Palestinian communities could be denied a drop of water for days and weeks, often as a form of collective punishment. The issue with the water is not just that of outright theft, denial of access, or unequal distribution of water resources. It is also that of the lack of clean and safe drinkable water, an issue that has been highlighted by international human rights groups for many years. The result of these unfair policies has forced many Palestinians to purchase water brought by trucks at prices ranging from 4 to 10 US dollars per cubic meter. Amnesty International found, highlighting that for the poorest Palestinian communities, water expenses can at times make up half of a family's monthly income. As bad as the situation may sound, the plight of besieged Gaza is much worse than that of the occupied West Bank. The tiny and overcrowded strip is the perfect example of the Zionist regime cruelty. 2 million Palestinians live there while being denied the most basic human rights, let alone freedom of movement. Since the Zionist regime military blockade on Gaza in 2007, the environment of coastal region has been in constant deterioration. With little electricity and with bombed-out sewage plants, Palestinians have been forced to dump their unprocessed sewage into the Gaza. Gaza's underground water is now polluted to the extent that 97% of the available water is now undrinkable, according to the United Nations reports. This is only the tip of the iceberg. From the destruction of Palestinian wells, to the poisoning of trees, to the demolishing of entire ecosystems to make space for the Zionist regime's apartheid wall, to the use of depleted uranium in its various wars against Gaza, the Zionist regime has been on an unrelenting mission to ruin Palestine's environment in all of its manifestations. Those who are hurting the planet have no right to claim the role of being its survivors. The Zionist regime in its current violent regime is the enemy of the environment, and this is what it truly should be known for.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.